Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Asiri, and each week I meet with military veterans to talk about their civilian career, what they do, how they got there, and advice for any other veterans who want to pursue that career path. Today is episode number 167 with Aaron Stachel.
He was running a company at the time, but he was a VC prior to that, and he had a very similar background to me. So he went to West Point. He was an Apache guy. He was in the first Iraq War. I was in the second Iraq War. He went to business school and then got a job in DC. And I was like, well, that's what I want to do too. How do I do that? And he said, don't bother. It's impossible. And and he wasn't really wrong. But you know, had I tried to get into the venture capital out of business school, I don't think I would have been successful.
Well, a special thanks to all of you who received my newsletter and filled out the survey about which types of interviews you'd like to hear more of. The number one requested type of interview was with someone in venture capital. And it has taken me a very long time to connect with a veteran who is in that career path. It is very, very rare. They are a unicorn crossed with a bald eagle. That's how rare this is. Aaron is awesome. I met him through a connection with a friend, and I think that you'll really enjoy this interview. If you're interested in venture capital, we cover a lot having to do with that, and the good, the bad, and the ugly. I think Aaron's very transparent on it. If you're interested in entrepreneurship, this is a great way to know your enemy. It's a great way to get a sense for what's happening on the other side of things if you choose to go down that path of fundraising. But even if you're not interested in venture capital or entrepreneurship, I think there's a lot that we discuss about that is really helpful. VCs are known for a high-intensity lifestyle of networking. And from my other interviews with Beyond the Uniform, I know that networking is a sticky subject with many people on active duty and many veterans. And so we talk about that, how veterans might approach networking in a way that makes sense for them. We talk about career paths. We talk about all sorts of different things, I think, that are relevant regardless of your career ambition. So I hope you enjoy this. My apologies about 40 minutes in, I let an F-bomb fly. That was not intentional. I got caught up in the heat of the moment of a very exciting conversation with Aaron. So apologies on that, but I'm not sorry enough to bleep it out. That's just too much work. As always, at beyondtheuniform.io, you'll find show notes that have links to everything we discuss. Aaron throws out four really, really great resources. If you're interested in venture capital or entrepreneurship, check them out in the show notes. Let me know what you think about this episode in the comments section right there. And if you have time after all of that, a positive review on iTunes would be greatly appreciated to help to get the word out about the show. So with that, let's dive in to my conversation with Aaron. Well, joining me today in Denver, Colorado, is Aaron Stachel. Aaron, welcome to Beyond the Uniform.
Hi, happy to be here.
I wanted to give listeners a quick background. Aaron is a principal at PV Ventures, which is a seed stage venture capital fund that primarily invests in Colorado-based software companies prior to their first institutional venture round. Aaron started out at West Point, after which he served as an aviation officer in the Army for 10 years. Aaron holds an MBA from the University of Denver. So Aaron, maybe to kick things off, if someone is on active duty and they're listening and somehow they've never heard of venture capital, how would you explain what venture capital is and what a venture capitalist does?
Yeah, I think an easy way to think about it is it's like a mutual fund for startups. So whereas a mutual fund gets a bunch of different investors, they pool that money together, and then they diversify it out across a portfolio of publicly traded stocks. We're doing something similar in that, you know, we go around to high net worth individuals that we call limited partners, and we get capital committed from them, and then we pool that into a fund that we take out and go and try and find early stage startup companies that we can invest in and own their equity, that and we expect them to grow and ultimately to get to an exit, and then we return our investors' capital plus a nice rate of return is the goal.
How are you finding these companies?
And so we get a lot of our deal flow from our network, and that includes other investors, technology executives that we know. Sometimes it comes via service providers like attorneys and consulting CFOs and people that work with a lot of startups that might be raising money. And so a lot of what I do is building a network of people that, you know, if they're starting a company or they know somebody that's starting a company that looks interesting, that they know to point them at us and to start a conversation.
And to set expectations for listeners, I want to try to get at some sort of breakdown of, you know, how many investments you make in a year versus how many companies you look at or people you meet with. Do you have a sense, you know, either on an annual or a weekly or a monthly basis of just what that breakdown is?
Yeah, it tends to be a little bit cyclical. So seasonal, I should say. So the spring tends to be very busy. The summer ends up being quiet, and then you end up with a very busy fall. And so it's kind of like everybody wants to get something done before the holidays, and then the holidays are slow, and then things ramp up again in the spring, and then the summer is slow. But on average, we probably get about something, you know, once a day to look at. So we'll look at probably a few hundred things a year, and we would probably invest in about, you know, eight to ten.
So just a fraction of those deals that you look at. What is it? I mean, you know, I imagine that many of the veterans listening to this are interested in entrepreneurship, and I imagine that some of them are interested in venture capital. I'm curious, you know, when you're looking at companies, what makes the difference between the investments you make and the investments you don't make? Like, what sorts of things stand out to you that make you think this is worth going in on?
Yeah, it's you know, at the stage that we invest, and we invest kind of pre-institutional VCs, so we call it seed rounds. So these are companies that have generally, a lot of them don't have any revenue yet. if they do, it's very early revenue. And so there's not, in terms of metrics that you would look at in evaluating a later stage private company or a public company in terms of margins and, growth rates and things like that, they just don't exist yet for the companies that we're investing in. So it's a lot more subjective. And so we tend to look at kind of the big picture in terms of, is it a large and growing market to where you can build a big business in it? Because venture capitalists are looking for things that can grow really big, really fast, to kind of condense that down. So the types of, things that we're looking at to see if that is possible, is it a big enough market where you can get a reasonable amount of market share and create a big company? Does the product kind of sales cycle and market, does it support, a fast growth rate? So you're looking for some structural things like that. And then you're looking at sort of a unique solution that's solving a problem in that big market. So, do the customers in that market feel, a strong pain point that this entrepreneur founding team is going out to solve? And is it a team that can execute? So, a big market, a great team that's going to go solve a big problem, a big important problem in that market, the type of problem that people are willing to go spend time and money implementing a solution. So it's really you know, we do a lot of due diligence around sort of validating assumptions around those things. But at the end of the day, it's a lot of qualitative judgments rather than quantitative, especially at the stage that we're investing.
And just to maybe set the landscape, you know, my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, but it seems like you've got, if you think of the life cycle of funding of a company, you've got probably like it starts with maybe the entrepreneur putting in money. Maybe it expands from there to like a friends and family round where they collect money from people who know them and believe in them. And then after that, it would be the seed stage. And then after that, a series A, B, C, all the way up to maybe even private equity investing, and then eventually maybe going public, and then being in the realm of public equity. Is that kind of the broad strokes of a fundraising cycle?
Yeah, that's exactly the right way to think about it. And so, as you mentioned, seed is on the very early part of that that curve where we invest.
What's you know, given that you focus on that seed stage, what are things that you like about that stage of a company, and what are some things that you dislike about dealing with companies at that stage?
Well, I think you know, it's kind of two sides of the same coin, but, you know, the thing I like about it is, you know, it's really sort of big picture vision, and kind of, you know, you're talking to these founding teams that, you know, the way that you make money in venture capital and being an entrepreneur is to figure something out that nobody else or very few people really understand yet. And so you're talking with these people that, you know, generally have a vision for the way that things are moving or changing, or a way to solve a problem in a new way that kind of unlocks a lot of value. And so that's a really exciting kind of place to be versus, you know, a later stage private equity investor. You know, they could get by without ever meeting the management team and just kind of studying the spreadsheets and the numbers and still do okay, where we're kind of really making a big bet on this team. And so getting to know them and understand them and their vision for the future, you meet a lot of interesting, really kind of people who are focusing on something that they're really passionate and excited about. And so I really love that part of it. You know, the downside of that is, you know, your decisions are, you know, there's a lot of risk at that stage. There's a lot of unknowns. And it's really easy to talk yourself out of just about any investment you want to do. And so trying to figure out when you should actually say yes is can be really challenging.
It's so funny you say that, because I think back to like business school, and I think back to stories you hear where, you know, if you could present Google or Amazon or Uber or some of these like incredible investments to a group of people, you know, in the earliest days, it's so easy to say no. I just imagine it must be so easy to poke holes in every single business. And it's interesting you say that, because it seems like it would be such a challenge of knowing when to actually put down a bet and when to listen to that voice that says no. But I imagine there's things that are worrisome and scary about every business.
Yeah, and it's, you know, we tend to focus more on enterprise software. So, you know, business to business software in general versus kind of consumer facing businesses. And I think, you know, because of our network and experience, we can get pretty good insight into whether, you know, we try and reduce the risk that the company's built something that nobody wants to buy. And so we try and mitigate that risk. You know, for consumer facing things, you know, there's kind of real visionaries in that space. I don't certainly consider, you know, us as one of them. Like if you would have showed me Snapchat, I would have said, well, that's stupid. Nobody's going to do that. And, but you know, there's people who are picking up on these trends and, or shaping these trends in a way that's really hard to predict.
Could you take us through, you know, I imagine there's a high degree of variability in your day, but could you take us through what a day might look like for you? And I know that listeners particularly like the details around you know, what time you get in, what time you leave, and just the types of things that occupy your day.
Yeah, I try and get going as early as I can in the morning, because I have four kids, so I don't have a lot of flex time on either end of the day. So I'm generally at my desk by 7:30. I work from home a lot of days. My firm is a very small partnership. It's just me and one other person, and we both work in different places. So I work from home a lot. I usually start my day at home, kind of reading, you know, catching up on email, reading. I get a variety of newsletters that are kind of specifically related to the types of things that we invest in. And so I look to see kind of who else is getting funding, you know, what else is getting funding, what the trends are, you know, what's going on in my industry in general. And then I usually end up with a series of phone calls and meetings throughout the day that can range from, you know, meeting with a potential company, kind of just meeting with somebody from a network. When I say potential company, a potential investment, sometimes I'm meeting with existing portfolio companies just to get caught up, figure out how we can be helpful, maybe help them think through a particular problem that they're having. I might meet with just general, you know, people in my network or people that I've been introduced to again, kind of back to that earlier point, you know, a lot of what I'm doing is building a network. So that I at least have a chance to see, you know, every good deal before it gets filled out. And then, you know, sometimes I'm back at my desk kind of doing some research on a particular company or space that we're interested in. And then I end up with a lot of evening events, you know, a lot of startup events that are social in nature, or pitch events where a group of investors will listen to a handful of startups pitch that are looking for money. A lot of those are in the evening, so the days can be long, but it's usually they're varied in the sense that you're working on different things kind of throughout the day, and over the week, you know, every day looks a little bit different in terms of where you're focused. Which for me and my personality tends to be a good fit.
Yeah, there's you know, there's a lot I'm envious of this career path. It seems like you know, one aspect is just like with consulting, I imagine that you are constantly exposed to the cutting edge of whatever your focus is. So yours is software. You're always reading and seeing, and you're always like up to speed on the latest trends, which seems like that would be very exciting. And you're also just it seems like a job that is highly socially driven, in that you are constantly meeting with people that you might invest in, and the people that you've met with, you might be helping them. And so you're constantly interacting with different people. And both of those seem like I could imagine why that would be appealing to many veterans who like to be on the cutting edge and also like to be around other people and interacting in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, I think, you know, as an aviation officer, I had a little bit of that where, you know, some days, you know, you're flying, or you're, you know, maybe you're in your office, you know, working on administrative stuff, or you're heading over to the hangar to meet with your maintenance guides, or you're headed over to the headquarters for a staff meeting or something. So, you know, I had a very varied pace in my Army life too, and I think it suits me. I think, you know, the people I think would struggle with this type of career, if you get really passionate about something and you really like to kind of sink your teeth into it and really dig in, that can be, you know, you won't get that. You know, and I end up knowing a little bit about a lot of things, but I never really, you know, become an expert or really dig in on any one thing. And so I think depending on your personality, that can be a pro or a con.
That's interesting. That seems probably similar to consulting as well, where it seems like your typical person in the military is really great at executing and probably enjoys the execution. And it seems like venture capital as well as consulting, you're not executing. You're more evaluating and maybe advising, but you're not actually like rolling up your sleeves and doing the work. And I can imagine that at times can be frustrating if you get really excited about an idea.
Yeah, it's very similar. The critics of consultants will say, they don't have any skin in the game, and they come up with a plan and leave, and somebody's got to actually do all the work. They might help you unearth some insights or help point you in a better direction, but at the end of the day, you've got to do the work. And it's no different in venture capital. We do have some skin in the game from the sense that we've invested some financial capital in the company, but at the end of the day, they've got to do all the work. We're helpful where we can be, but we really don't get to take that much credit for it, nor should we.
This industry of venture capital has been probably the most requested industry from listeners. I know there's been a lot of interest in this, and it's taken me a long time to find someone. There's just not a lot of veterans who have gone into venture capital. And I was curious if you'd be willing to share your story of, like, how did you go from the Army to ending up in this highly sought after but also extremely difficult to obtain role?
Yeah, so I get this question a lot, kind of to your point. A lot of people are interested in it. And besides, will you fund my company? How do I get into VC tends to be sort of the other most asked question. So my story was I came out of the Army. I was in Colorado. My wife's an attorney, and we loved it here. We wanted to stay here. She had a great job. And so I did my MBA here, University of Denver. And while I was in business school, I worked with some startups my military network was great. So I got an internship working for a venture-backed company that was run by a former Navy F-14 pilot, Top Gun guy, who I got connected to through a business school professor who was a former Navy pilot. And pulled me into this group of sort of ex-military aviators who would grab a beer every once in a while. And so that pulled me into an internship with a venture-backed company, and I got really kind of excited about working in an early-stage company. And then things were kind of in a little bit of tumult. That CEO actually got replaced right before I finished business school, and I ended up having to go find another job. I ended up taking a job at a big global mining company, doing some M&A and investor relations and strategy work. And then after a little over a year, it was apparent that this is, not anywhere close to those cool startups I was working at business school. And I started, reaching out to that network I built to find my way back. And another military connection, a former Air Force officer who I had done some volunteer work for in business school, and he was running a different startup, connected me to my partner now, who is an entrepreneur who has created his own small fund, primarily his own capital, and then wanted to build some structure around that and raise more outside capital and create more of a firm around kind of what he was doing personally. And they had recently had a conversation that he was getting so busy, he wasn't going to be able to grow this without some help. And I was just in the right place at the right time and got connected to him. And it was a very small fund. Again, it was mostly his own capital, but I was in a good place where we didn't have kids yet. My wife was had a good job, and we could take a little bit more risk reward. So it was just kind of the right opportunity at the right time. And, it's been 5 years now. So, it's funny because when I was in business school, there was a guy, who spoke on a panel in a class I was in, who was running a company at the time, but he was a VC prior to that. And he had a very similar background to me. So he went to West Point. He was an Apache guy. He was in the first Iraq War. I was in the second Iraq War. He went to business school, and then got a job in VC. And I was like, well, that's what I want to do too. How do I do that? And he said, don't bother. It's impossible. and he wasn't really wrong, but, you know, had I tried to get into to venture capital out of business school, I don't think I would have been successful.
Yeah, it seems like it's, you know, a mixture of having the right skill set and serendipity, but also putting yourself out there and always meeting people. And so it's an interesting, you know, probably similar elements to so many other interviews I've done before. But I can imagine it's almost like getting struck by lightning. It seems
it's a very small industry, and in a place like Colorado, it's tiny. You know, there's only a handful of funds, and a lot of them don't even hire any junior level employees. You know, in the Bay Area, especially in the coast in general, there's a lot of large funds that have enough fee income that they hire analysts and associates, and you know, they're big enough that they bring them in on a semi-regular basis. You know, but those are really, again, those are really competitive jobs to get. Most of those guys or girls come from, you know, they've worked in technology, they've come from the best schools or MBA programs, extremely competitive. And the other thing is those entry-level roles rarely transition into a career path. The general sort of, you know, associate role at a VC firm is a 2 to 3 year stint, and then you're expected to leave. And a lot of them will either join a portfolio company of that firm, or they will maybe go start their own company. But you know, most of the investing partners were founders, or they came in as an investing partner after they had maybe some success running a company. Or you know, some people get into venture from private equity or investment banking. Those are some of the typical paths.
It is interesting that you point that out, because it does seem like that there's a pretty big moat between the entry level positions and then the more senior level ones. And I like that you point that out, that there is that 2 to 3 year period in which the junior associate or the associate's looking at deals and potentially joining one, or maybe, you know, ideally they're seeing so many different companies on a daily basis that they start to see a trend or maybe a need in the market or a direction that things are going, and that might be an edge for their starting their own company. But to make it to that senior level, to make it to that partner, it seems like, you know, just anecdotally, most of them were either really successful entrepreneurs, or they were really successful operators that were able to then change them to investing. Or like you said, they did investing in some other capacity, like private equity or something like that, and made that switch. But yeah. It's one of the only fields I can think of where there's not a direct promotion internally. It's not like you start there and you work your way up over a decade.
Yeah, it is a little bit unique. Like if you're going to be a partner at a law firm, the way you would do that is get a, you know, associate job at a law firm and work your way up until they make you partner. And you know, that happens in DC. It's just kind of rare.
Yep. One thing I'm wondering is, you know, I know a lot of people listening to this, and you know, just statistically, a lot of veterans aspire to start their own company. I'm wondering if you have any advice for a veteran who wants to start a company in terms of how do they get in front of someone like you? Like, what is the way in which one goes about raising money?
Yeah, I think, you know, one caveat to that question is most businesses, you know, either can't or shouldn't raise venture capital. Venture capital is a very sort of unique funding mechanism that works really well, again, for things that can grow really big, really fast and end up consuming a lot of capital. You know, most companies, you know, most of them raise a little bit of friends and family or angel money to get started, but then they tend to they tend to sell stuff for more than it costs them to make or deliver their service. So, yeah, they make profits and they grow kind of slowly over time. Maybe they can access bank debt eventually, but you know, the vast majority of businesses grow that way. So I think there's a misperception that, you know, I've got a startup company and it's young and it's small, so, you know, the right funding source is venture capital. And that tends to not be the case more often than not. But if you do find yourself in the type of company that can grow really big, really fast, and in order to do that, you're going to consume capital, then it can be a really great fit. And it, you know, it ends up being a win for the investors and a win for the founders. And, you know, a little bit depends on where you're at. You know, I'm in a, you know, the venture sort of market is in a very, you know, it's very skewed. So, you know, California has, you know, the lion's share of venture capital firms. And then it's a big step down to New York and Boston. And then it's another big step down to kind of Colorado, Texas, and Washington State. And then it's another step down after that. So if you're in sort of like a top five market, like we are here in Colorado, there's going to be a decently active sort of angel investor community, which is where most people start. You know, your angel investors are usually a great way to get connected to the local VC firms. You know, again, you've probably got advisors and mentors, you know, your peers of other entrepreneurs that have started companies and raised money. You know, that's one of the great things about a lot of these companies that work in a co-working space. You know, there's somebody around you who's solved the problem that you're trying to solve in a lot of ways or a lot of times. And so, you know, you kind of have to leverage that network, and getting a warm intro is, you know, often better than coming in cold through the website. But I do look at everything that hits our contact form on our website, and I'll take a look and see if it might fit our high level criteria and if it's worth taking an intro call or meeting. So those are kind of the typical ways. I think that answered the question.
Yeah. No, and it's interesting too. That's like another industry where, you know, maybe finance is like that, but it's like it is very geographically specific. Like you rattled off the five or six locations that's kind of where it is. And there's a big gap between even those. And, you know, most industries, most functional roles, it seems like no matter where you go, you'll find something. But for venture capital, I don't think that's the case. I think it's like a very limited geographic area.
Yeah. And that I was stuck on, there's something else I wanted to say. I was getting stuck on it, but you reminded me that, you know, if you're in a top five market, you know, you can find your way to the VC funds in your area. If you're kind of outside of that, there's a decent chance there might not be a local VC fund at all. And, you know, that early stage capital doesn't travel much. And so when you're trying to get somebody from out of state to invest in your startup at a really early stage, the bar is going to go up for you and it's going to be even harder. So you might have to make it a little bit farther along than you would otherwise to get people to potentially get on a plane and take that extra effort. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of a really important thing to understand. There's a lot of funds popping up sort of in the middle of the country that are focused on investing in the middle of the country because they believe there's a lot of kind of talent and innovation that doesn't have the access to capital that we see on the coastal market. So there's more and more firms like that, you know, if you're in kind of the middle of the country, you can find your way to.
Mm. One other question that occurred to me while you were saying that is just kind of, so the three arbitrary buckets that I'd come up with for your time, it seems like some of your time is raising money for your firm to invest. A certain, you know, one bucket would be meeting with companies and deciding whether or not to invest in them. And then a third bucket might be meeting with the companies that you've invested in or providing help for them in some way. So one question I have is first of all, is that a fair assessment of the buckets of your time? But then also, like, if you were to look at a pie chart of a year, what's the rough distribution between those three different categories?
Yeah, that's a good point. So, you know, we're just sort of, you know, most venture funds raise a new fund every sort of 3 to 4 years. And we're just entering that sort of fundraising cycle. So our second fund that we're investing now is at the tail end of the investment period where we've kind of built the portfolio. And so now we need to make, you know, go raise a new fund to be able to keep making those new investments. And so, you know, part of, you know, in terms of the investor relations side of it, some of it is fundraising, which is, you know, which the entrepreneurs that we invest in have to go do. They, you know, they go talk to a lot of people and most of them say no. And they, you know, they end up kind of scraping together what they need in the end. And, you know, that's a full-time job. Both when we do it and when founders do it, it's very time consuming. You take a lot of meetings, a lot of follow-up meetings, a lot of phone calls, making presentations. So I'm entering a phase where I'm going to start spending a lot of time on that. Mm. And then once the fundraising's over, there's still an investor relations component of, you know, we write quarterly letters to, you know, inform our investors what's going on with our portfolio. We do annual meetings to keep them informed and so that they feel good about that they understand what's going on and how things are going. So that tends to be a kind of a long cycle, like a 3-year type of cycle. And then once we raise the fund, we spend a lot of time, you know, over the next few years, you know, we're building that portfolio. And then as our portfolio has grown, we have over 33 companies now across two funds. Yeah, you end up spending time on those companies because, you know, they want to talk through something or something's not going well and they need to raise more money. Or you're trying to get them an introduction into a potential partner or customer or somebody that they're trying to hire. And so it tends, you know, that the kind of helping existing companies, that tends to be pretty varied for us because we're such an early stage fund. Our portfolio model is based on making a lot of, you know, building a big portfolio of high risk, high reward opportunities that, you know, again, don't have a lot of traction yet. There's a lot of risk. A lot of them just aren't going to work out no matter how well we try and pick them. And out of the 30 companies we'll do in this current fund, probably a half a dozen of them are really going to matter from an economic standpoint in the end. And then there'll be another dozen that do okay, but don't really move the needle. And then another dozen that might not return any capital at all. Mm. And so we're doing, you know, 8 to 10, maybe even 12 investments in a given year. And so our ability to really roll up our sleeves and spend a lot of time with any individual company is limited, and more limited than maybe we would like it to, but our model is sort of built around kind of how many deals we think we need to get done to be properly diversified with a balance of being, you know, concentrated enough so that when we do have a big win, it really matters to our fund. You know, for a later stage VC, that I think that dynamic looks a little bit different in that, you know, an investment partner at a big firm might only do 1 or 2 deals per year. You know, there might be a handful of partners and they each do 1 or 2 a year. They write big checks. They take a board seat. They really roll up their sleeves. And, you know, they might have at a minimum a weekly call with the CEO, you know, quarterly board meetings. And, you know, over time, they a partner at a bigger fund might spend the majority of their time working on the existing portfolio companies and not as much time looking at new deals, which is where they, you know, they tend to hire junior level staff to do a lot of that kind of screening. So if you do end up going to work for a big fund, you know, you're looking through those hundreds of opportunities, finding the ones that the partners should spend their time on, because, you know, they're basically going kind of between, you know, board meetings and update calls for their existing portfolio. So it looks a lot different for a later stage fund than it does at an earlier one like ours.
That's funny that you point that out, because it's definitely a trend, you know, regardless of industry, that if you go to, it seems like if you go to a smaller company, you're going to be wearing multiple hats and involved in multiple activities, and you'll see probably a broader spectrum of what makes that particular company work. And if you go to a much bigger company, you're a lot more defined in the specificity of your exact role. And so it's interesting that that holds true for venture capital as well, where at these bigger firms, you know, you won't be really responsible for fundraising, or, you know, it's just you'll be a little bit more discreet in the type of work that you're doing.
Right. And there, you know, I don't consider myself an entrepreneur, but there's definitely, you know, a startup aspect to being at a small sort of young firm where, you know, the upside is that, you know, I'm kind of here at the beginning and I'm helping to create it and grow with it. But like you said, it's a little bit like a startup, you know, and you kind of have to be willing and ready to do anything that needs to get done, because there's nobody else to do it. Where at these really big funds, you know, they might have a partner that just helps existing portfolios with PR or marketing or, you know, legal issues or recruiting, or, you know, where at a small fund, you know, you don't have those resources at your disposal.
One thing that comes to mind is it seems like your job entails an extensive amount of networking. Like, it seems like you are constantly meeting with people, maintaining relationships, building relationships, getting referrals. And at the same time, I'm aware that in the last 165 interviews, almost every single veteran I speak with talks about, at least at first, the difficulty they have approaching networking, and how when they're in the military, they view that in a very negative light, and it's something that they're not excited about as they approach their transition. Do you have any advice for people on active duty about how they might approach networking in a way that doesn't feel slimy or doesn't feel like it goes against their values or their culture?
Yeah, I think just to kind of reiterate your point, it's, you know, it is extremely important. And I was a little bit, you know, it was an eye opener for me. You know, I was able to get a job coming out of my MBA program kind of through a company that was on campus recruiting. But, you know, I was surprised that once I got to this big company, that how important networking still was, because, you know, it's not like the Army where, you know, or, you know, another service where you can kind of plot out a 20-year career and you might not know exactly where you're going to be or exactly which job you're going to be doing, but you have a general idea of how things will look. And that doesn't exist in a lot of corporate America, and kind of where your career path takes you, a lot of it depends on the relationships that you build, and you work your way up and around a company by getting to know people and making sure they, you know, understand kind of the, you know, your expertise and the value that you provide, and realize that you're, you know, the type of person that they want on their team that they can trust and rely on. And so, you know, that doesn't just happen because it's, you know, you've been in a certain role for a certain amount of time and the military wants you to move and go do something else now. You have to kind of make that happen. So it's extremely important, I think, for a variety of reasons, regardless of kind of where you end up. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, you know, you're really just trying to build relationships with people. You know, if you look at it where, you know, I need to go meet people that can help me and I'm going to ask them for stuff, then it does kind of feel slimy because it feels one-sided. But if you go into it from the perspective of, you know, I'm not going here to ask for anything. I'm going here to build a relationship with people and, you know, figure out kind of what they do. And maybe there's a way that I can be helpful to them. And, you know, and Colorado is well known for its entrepreneurial community having a motto called Give First. And the idea is that, you know, you engage with the community first by, you know, providing some value, and people will kind of reciprocate with, you know, providing you value when the time is right. And so, you know, a lot of what networking isn't just meeting people, but it's building a relationship. So when the time is right and you need something from them, you need some help, or, you know, they're willing to help you because they've gotten to know you, and you, maybe you've done something to help them versus just, you know, asking people for stuff all the time. And I think, you know, the benefit you have when you're leaving the military is, you know, it's really easy to say, hey, I'm getting out of the military. I've been kind of going back and forth to the Middle East or wherever, and, you know, I haven't really thought hard about what I want to do. I'd really like to buy you a cup of coffee and understand kind of what you do and get some advice. And you've got, you know, the ability to kind of leverage your service to the country. You know, a lot of people, I think, are willing to give you that time. And I certainly try, you know, there's a lot of people who did that for me, and I always try and do that, especially for other veterans who are trying to sort through that.
I love that. I mean, two things that stood out to me is first, I don't think I really put my finger on it till you said it, but it's like there's this aspect of when you're in the military, there is such a strong current where you can kind of stay still without expending a lot of energy, and the system will promote you or direct you. Like, if you don't take any action, you're right, still going to end up somewhere. And on the flip side of that, in the civilian sector, at least my experience, and it sounds like yours as well, it's like you have to have a fair amount of volition, and you have to put a fair amount of energy into the system to change states. If you want to go to a different right, job or be promoted or a different, you know, area geographically, it's not going to happen without a fair amount of elbow grease. And so I like what you're saying, which is like networking or relationship building or whatever term someone wants to give it that feels okay to them. That's the primary vehicle that happens. It happens through, you know, I would say of 165 interviews, I would say at least 60 or 70% of people got their job because they knew someone or someone told them about an opportunity. It wasn't just them going through the front door. So I think that relationships play a pretty big role for people in their career. But what I like, the second thing I like that you said is this thought of approaching it as adding value. And I like Gary Vaynerchuk and his podcast, Gary V. He talks a lot. He even wrote a book that was called, I think it was Jab, 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 Right Hook. And his thought was like, the jab is giving to people, and then the right hook is having some sort of request. But it's always like, give, give, give. And he said if he were to rewrite the book today, it'd be like, jab, 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 right hook. It's like the amount of giving and adding value is far exceeding making any sort of request. And I, you know, from my experience, most veterans, I think, are very giving. I mean, they took like an oath to like to like put their country first. Like, they're exceptionally giving, and I think that sort of teamwork approach comes naturally. And so what I like about what you said is taking that approach of, you know, adding value. Like, hey, here's someone. What could I do to help them out? Is there anything I can do or say that will help them out? And if that's your mode of operation, eventually, you know, I'm a believer, you can call it karma or whatever you want to call it, like eventually things come back to you. But coming from that place of giving might feel more authentic and natural rather than like, I'm going to do this in order to get something in return. It's kind of, I don't know if that makes sense, but that's what came through from what you were saying. And I really like that as an approach.
Yeah, I think that's right. And like I said, you know, it's, you may not have an obvious way to add value, but you know, when you're making the transition, you're in a great kind of place based on your service to ask for people to give first to you.
Yep.
And most of them will be more than willing You know, sometimes it's hard. You know, people are really busy and, you know, you can't get in front of them. And sometimes you have to be persistent. But most people will make, you know, make some time for you, at least a phone call or answer some questions over email or something. Mm. I met an entrepreneur, in Colorado recently who was struggling to find, you know, opportunities through the normal channels. And after, some time, in the Navy, they had just, you know, reached out directly to some really, you know, well-placed individuals in the kind of tech world and, you know, were able to get in front of them and made things happen kind of, just kind of through sheer will and people's, you know, willingness to look at them as like, you know, this person has done a lot for this country and, you know, I'm going to give them a little bit of time. And it worked out really well.
Is there any resources you would recommend if someone is listening to this and they're fired up, they think that they want to learn more about venture capital and this as a career path? Is there any resources you would recommend that could be a book, podcast, conference, TV show, anything that might help better inform them?
Yeah, I, you know, in the venture community, a trend in the last, you know, really since I started doing this 5 years ago, there was some content out there. You know, one of the ones I'll recommend is a VC by the name of Fred Wilson at Union Square Ventures in New York has a website called AVC, so AVC, .com. And he does a daily blog. A lot of them are short. And they're just about startups and venture capital and things kind of he's seen as a, you know, after a long career. Very successful career in VC. And he did a series of these called MBA Mondays where he took a specific topic and kind of blogged about it. And there's an archive of these somewhere that are, you know, really, you know, quick, well-informed reads to kind of get you up to speed on a lot of the lingo and topics that I found very helpful when I was getting started. Likewise, Brad Feld, who's a VC here in Colorado, wrote a book with his partner called Venture Deals. And if you're looking to get into venture or you're looking to raise money as an entrepreneur, it's a great, again, a really easy read. It's a pretty short book, if I remember. And it really just helps you understand how these deals are structured and what the main kind of deal points that people negotiate around are and a perspective on kind of what the market is, that really provides a great overview on how fundraising happens. But you know, there's a ton of content out there. What I was going to say is, you know, Fred Wilson was like the only one doing it for a while. And I think Brad Feld was really early, but now, you know, every VC is trying to sort of compete for deal flow and they want to be seen as an expert in whatever area. So, you know, there's like a million VC podcasts and blogs and things out there right now. And sometimes it's hard to sort through them, but there's a couple great newsletters. One of them is CB Insights, which is sort of an industry analyst firm that covers early stage and private companies. They do a daily newsletter, and at the bottom of that, you know, they have some interesting insights of their own. And at the bottom, there's, you know, a handful of links to articles that they've found interesting. And a company called Mattermark, a similar company with a similar newsletter, does a daily newsletter that kind of surfaces and highlights, you know, a handful of blog posts or articles every day that are. You know, they sort through all those, you know, hundreds of things out there and kind of surface a handful that are really worth reading. And so those are great, great places to get started.
This is awesome. And for listeners at beyondtheuniform.io, I'll add in the show notes for this episode, I'll add links to all four of those. Those are really fantastic recommendations. So Aaron, I always like to keep the last question open-ended, which is I've asked a ton of questions that I thought would be helpful to our audience, but I'm sure there's things that I didn't ask about. So I would love to just kind of turn the mic over to you and just say, what else have we not covered that you would like to share with listeners?
Yeah, let me think about that for a second. Yeah, I think, you know, in terms of going into venture capital and into startups, you know, I think, you know, one thing that I don't think I fully appreciated till I was in this world was the sort of risk reward paradigm that, you know, especially in the military, you know, your kind of salary, you know, if you just sort of keep, you know, as long as you don't get fired, you kind of know exactly how much money you're going to make at any kind of different grade or years in service. You can kind of figure all that out. You know, your healthcare is taken care of, et cetera. Whereas if you jump into the startup world and working at a small fund has a lot of this kind of dynamic, you know, if we're not successful, then we can't really raise another fund, and we're going to run out of fees from the current fund. And, you know, you basically have to go find something else to do. And if you're working at a startup, you know, most startups fail. I mean, that's just a fact of life. As much as, you know, you hate to think about that, if you look at the statistics, you know, that we invest at the seed stage, less than half the companies that raise a seed round even make it to, you know, that first institutional Series A round. So, you know, the risk and kind of how many things just don't work out. And venture funds, you know, a lot of them don't work out and deliver high returns. So you have to be comfortable with taking that elevated amount of risk that, you know, if things don't work out, yeah, you're going to have to go find something else to do. And you're going to, you know, a lot of times in this world, it's, you know, people don't hold your failures against you because, you know, that's just the reality. And a lot of times you get some scars and you learn some things that are going to help you on the next time around. You know, the flip side of that is when things work out, they can work out really, really well. You know, if you've, you know, as a startup founder or as a venture capitalist that builds a great portfolio and delivers big returns, you're getting a cut of that return, typically called a carried interest. So, you know, you have to be comfortable with the fact that, you know, you're going to get usually a salary, but the majority of your compensation is going to come from some performance. And, you know, it takes a long time to figure that out. A venture fund is usually a 10-year limited partnership. You know, a lot of startups aren't going to exit until they're, you know, 7 years or more down the road. So you're really kind of committing to something for a long time, probably not making a ton of money in the short term. And then things, you know, with the hopes that things will work out and you'll do really well. And if things don't work out, you probably would have been better off financially doing something a little bit more stable where, you know, there is a path in the office to a, you know, a bump in pay or a promotion or some added benefits that that don't really exist in the kind of early stage startup and investing world. So it's you have to have a personal situation and I think a personality that accepts that sort of risk reward trade-off. Versus working in maybe a larger organization that's more stable in some ways and maybe has a more predictable kind of path forward, but maybe not as much upside.
It's I appreciate your pointing out the risk because I think that that's something that people overlook on both entrepreneurship and venture capital. But I think one thing that strikes me about that is that when I do talk to veterans, I would say 90% of the time they have a very negative view on sales, particularly around, I don't want to take a job that has you know, minimal pay, and there's a lot of risk involved in how much I make. And yet there's so much interest in venture capital. And I realize they're very different career paths, but both have a high degree of variability in what you actually earn based on performance. And so it's just interesting to me that, as you point out, that risk, that risk is shared in many different industries. But I think people often overlook that with venture capital.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's not as quite as extreme as it is being an entrepreneur, because we do have a portfolio of opportunities to spread that risk across. And we have, you know, once we raise a fund, we have fees from that fund that come in over a certain period of time. Mm. So it's certainly not on the same level as if you're, you know, you're starting a company and you've got a year of runway, and you either make progress and raise more money or get to break even, or you run out of money and got to do something else. So it's not as severe, but it's definitely something that, you know, in general in this world, it's that risk reward framework is something I think you don't really appreciate till you see it up close. Like, I was around some startups in business school, and it seemed like a great way to make a lot of money. And it wasn't until I got into what I'm doing now that I realized, you know, it is a great way to make a lot of money when things work out. The reality is most things don't end up being big wins. Mm.
Well, Aaron, I know we are right up at the end of our time here, but I really appreciate your taking the time to speak with me and to share your story. And I know it's such a rare path, but I appreciate the candor that you bring to the conversation about sharing the good, the bad, and the ugly about it. And I think this will go over really well with the community. I appreciate it.
Great. I'm happy to do it, and I'm always happy to help veterans think about their career transition. So if you add my website link to the show notes, there's a contact form on there, and it comes straight to me. So feel free to reach out if you have follow-up questions from anybody in the audience.
I always feel on the stinger of these episodes that it's like that Ferris Bueller moment where he looks in, Matthew Broderick looks into the camera and says, "You're still here?" at the end of the movie. So if you have stuck around this long, thanks for listening. I would always welcome any feedback on how to improve the show, what sorts of guests you'd like. You can email me at justin@beyondtheinformed.io. You can leave a comment in the comment section, or you can reply to my twice a month email newsletter that you can sign up for at beyondtheuniform.io. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Aaron. It took a very long time to find someone with his background, and I think he covered a lot of ground that's just very, very helpful if you're evaluating this as a career path. And although we talk about how difficult it is to achieve this, there are still many veterans that achieve this career path. So if you're excited about this, don't let the numbers deter you, but let them inform you on how to go about trying to get this this sort of position. So that is all for today. I will be back next week with more interviews with military veterans about their civilian career. Have a fantastic week.